Whitey Bulger is one of the most notorious gangsters in history. He ran South Boston for decades, all while cooperating with the FBI. In exchange for information on other criminal groups, the Bureau let Bulger get away with anything, including murder. Then, in 1994, he vanished, just as authorities were closing in. I'm Brian McCoy. Welcome to The Mob Files. Hello everyone and welcome into episode 6 of The Mob Files. Today, we will be wrapping up our discussion of the Irish mob in Boston with the story of Whitey Bulger. I mentioned in the first Boston episode that Bulger overshadows a lot of other Irish gangsters in Boston's history. After researching his life, it's not hard to understand why this is the case. Bulger was the top mobster in South Boston, while at the same time serving as an informant for the FBI. The details of how this played out are fascinating. Let's get started. James Joseph Bulger was born on September 3, 1929. When Bulger was young, his father lost his arm in an accident at work. He could no longer work full-time, and as a result, the Bulger family was very poor. In 1938, the family moved into the Old Harbor Housing Project in South Boston. Whitey grew up with two brothers, William and John. The contrast between Whitey and his brother Billy are fascinating, and the differences were apparent very early on. Billy was an excellent student who enjoyed school and loved to read. He eventually graduated from Boston College Law School and entered into politics. Whitey, on the other hand, took to the streets almost immediately. He became known at a young age as a ready participant in street fights and as a thief. His specialty early on was boosting merchandise off of delivery trucks. At 13, he was charged with larceny for the first time. He was involved with the Shamrocks gang by the age of 14 and was arrested multiple times for various violent crimes before his 18th birthday. He largely managed to avoid lasting trouble with law enforcement, but he was roughed up by the Boston police from time to time. The legend of Whitey Bulger was already in full effect. The neighborhood kids, including future FBI agent John Connolly, were in awe of him. Whitey relished this attention and loved the reputation he had already built up. After serving in the Air Force for 4 years, not without controversy, he was arrested multiple times by military police, he returned home to Boston. The time in the military did not reform Bulger. Bulger quickly moved on to bigger criminal ventures and was busted in his late 20s for armed robbery. He was first sent to the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, where he quickly became known as a less than model prisoner. He was often sent to solitary confinement, and at one point he did a 3-month stretch in the hole. After being suspected of planning an escape in Atlanta, he was transferred to Alcatraz in California. He had forced the Fed's hand and made it clear he needed to be in a maximum security facility. He eventually accepted his fate and calmed down to serve his time. He had stops at Leavenworth in Kansas and Lewisburg in Pennsylvania before being released in 1965. He had served 9 years in federal prison. Bulger would not see the inside of a jail cell again for more than 45 years. Upon his return to Boston, Bulger got a job as a janitor at a courthouse thanks to Billy's connections. Whitey worked jobs like this for a couple of years, staying out of trouble for the most part. But the call of the underworld was too strong, and he decided it was time to jump back in. Bulger was a much different criminal than he was prior to his time in federal prison. He had used his time to learn from his youthful mistakes and plan how he could operate while flying under the radar. He was determined not to make those same mistakes that had cost him 9 years of his life. While he was in prison, he researched law enforcement tactics and where other mobsters had gone wrong in the past. He even went as far as reading up on World War II generals and the mistakes they had made. When he jumped back into the game, Bulger decided to work for Donald Killeen, who at that time was the number one bookie in South Boston. Killeen, along with his brothers Donnie, Kenny, and Eddie, dominated Southie. As I detailed in the previous episode, the Killeens were engaged in a constant battle with the Mullen gang in the late 60s and early 70s. Bulger became increasingly convinced that the Killeens would not be able to survive the war with the Mullens, and that he would be killed along with the brothers. He realized that he had to team up with the stronger group to survive. Bulger was not going to work with the Italians, so his only real option was the Winter Hill gang. Bulger entered into secret talks with Winter Hill and the Mullens to take out Donald Killeen and end the war. Under the agreement, Bulger would take over operations in South Boston. All parties agreed it was in their collective best interest for the Mullens and whatever associates of the Killeens who survived to join forces and work under the umbrella of Winter Hill. Howie Winter, who at that time was the boss of the Winter Hill gang, was instrumental in making this happen. Shortly thereafter, Donald Killeen was hit. He had received a phone call to come outside during his son's birthday party. Obviously, it was from someone he trusted. A gunman approached Killeen and sprayed a 15-round burst with the machine gun into Killeen's face. Nobody was convicted of the murder, but the widely held belief is that Bulger facilitated the hit. At this point, the surviving Killeen brothers backed off and the war was over. Whitey Bulger now worked for Howie Winter. The Mullins and Winter Hill were supposed to be working together at this point. After all, they had agreed that there was plenty of work to go around. In line with their prior agreement, Bulger was given control of Southie by Winter. But this wasn't enough for Bulger. He had his sights set much higher. In the early 70s, he convinced Howie Winter to greenlight hits on various Mullen gang members. As a result, Winter Hill's power kept growing. As I explained in the previous episode, Winter Hill began to have cash flow problems in the 70s. Their usual rackets weren't bringing in enough cash. This forced them to move into new areas of business, including fixing horse races. There are several ways to fix a horse race. A common tactic is to find a good horse with a good record and hype it up, get people to place a lot of bets on it. Then, in a big race, you pay the jockey to throw it. This is what Winter Hill did. They would do this and then place bets on the other horses to win or place in a certain position. Howie Winter had partnered with experienced race fixer Anthony Fat Tony Shula on this operation. Shula knew the ins and outs of horse racing, and Winter Hill had the money to finance the operation. Things were great at first, and this was an extremely profitable endeavor for Winter Hill. The FBI estimated that they had made profits of more than $8 million fixing races on the East Coast. Things went south when a jockey in New Jersey started cooperating with the state police. Shula was arrested and convicted for fixing races. He initially didn't rat on Howie Winter, but jail proved to be too much for him to handle, and he started talking in 1976. The FBI was brought into the fold, and by early 1977, Shula was freed from jail and put in federal witness protection. He had snitched on Winter Hill. In 1979, Howie Winter and a lot of his inner circle were arrested based on Shula's information. Winter was convicted and sent away. Whitey Bulger and Stephen Fleming were left off of the indictment. They were instead listed as unindicted co-conspirators. This meant they got to avoid jail and could take over the gang. You might be asking yourself how Bulger and Fleming were lucky enough to be left off the indictment when all the other high-ranking members of Winter Hill were not. The answer is that they had help on the inside. By this point in time, again we're talking the late 70s, Bulger and Fleming had both been working with the feds for years. Stephen Fleming was born in 1934 in Boston. After serving in the army during the Korean War, he returned to Boston and entered the criminal life. He was known as a tough enforcer and loan shark, and he did a lot of this work for the mafia. Fleming caught the eye of Raymond Patriarca, boss of the Patriarca crime family, who operated in Boston as well as in Providence, Rhode Island. In 1967, Fleming was invited to have lunch in Providence with the boss. Patriarca liked Fleming and wanted to work with him. Suffice it to say, Fleming had a lot of access to high-ranking mafia figures. They even offered to make Fleming a made guy at one point, but he didn't trust them. He especially wasn't comfortable working with Ilario Zanino. Zanino was a made guy in the Patriarca family and had worked to bring Fleming into the fold, but he was also a hothead. Fleming was worried that Zanino would turn on him for whatever reason and kill him out of nowhere. It didn't make sense to work with a guy like that. The FBI had observed all this and knew that Fleming could be a valuable asset. The Bureau had its sights set on the Mafia in Boston, and they specifically wanted to go after Jerry Angiulo, Patriarca's underboss who led the crews in the city. They were willing to cut deals with other gangsters to gather intel on Angiulo and his underlings. Stephen Fleming had been approached by FBI agent Paul Rico in the mid-1960s and agreed to provide information on the Mafia. As with Fleming, the FBI believed Whitey Bulger was a prime target to provide information on the Mafia. After all, it would greatly benefit him to do so. The FBI had tried multiple times to bring Bulger into the fold. Agent Dennis Condon achieved some success in the early 70s when he persuaded Bulger to provide information about the ongoing Irish gang war in the city. But what the FBI really wanted, what they really needed, was information to bring down the Patriarchas. Condon tried to get this information from Bulger, but Whitey was hesitant. The relationship broke down, and by September 1971, Condon was ready to give up and close Bulger's informant file. What the Bureau really needed was someone Bulger could trust. John Connolly was the man for the job. John Connolly was born on August 1, 1940 in Boston. He grew up in the same old harbor housing project as the Bulgers. He was 6 years younger than Billy and 11 years younger than Whitey. John became friends with Billy, who helped him get interested in books and in school. The age gap between Connolly and Whitey was too large for them to really cross paths much, but, like most of the kids in the neighborhood, Connolly was in awe of Whitey. By the time Connolly was 10 years old, Whitey was already a legend in Southie. Connolly eventually joined the FBI and did stints in Baltimore, San Francisco, and New York City before being transferred to the Boston field office in 1973. Connolly, with the support of his supervisors, decided to take another run at Bulger. He believed that the Bureau had failed to bring Whitey in because the agents assigned to the task didn't have a connection to Bulger. They didn't come from Southie, let alone the same housing project as him. Connolly made his move in 1975, setting up a meeting with Whitey at a beach just down the road from Southie. During the nighttime meeting, Connolly made his pitch to Bulger. He explained how the relationship could benefit both of them. The FBI wanted information on its number one target, the Mafia, and Bulger would benefit from his number one rival being weakened. Connolly also heavily implied that the Bureau had intel that the Mafia was planning a war with Winter Hill. While the Mafia certainly didn't like the Irish and saw them as a threat, there was actually no evidence that such a conflict was imminent. Whitey was hesitant, but he ultimately agreed. John Connolly had successfully brought Whitey Bulger into the fold. Fast forwarding again to 1979, with Howie Winter headed to prison, Bulger was now the boss of Winter Hill. By the late 70s and early 80s, Bulger's had added another mobster to his inner circle, Kevin Weeks. Weeks was significantly younger than Bulger and Flemmy, but it impressed them after working as a bouncer at one of their favorite spots, the Triple O's Lounge. Weeks started doing some work for Bulger in the late 70s, and was a full-on mobster by the early 80s. Bulger, with help from Flemmy and Weeks, dominated the underworld of Boston in the 80s. Everything ran through him. You wanted to run a sports book? Whitey got a share. You wanted to run a backroom card game? Whitey got a share. You wanted somebody dead? Whitey had to sign off on it. You get the idea. The rackets run by Winter Hill during this time were typical of organized crime. Loan sharking, bookmaking, extortion. They did, however, branch out into other areas that were not as typical. A prime example of this is arms trafficking. Bulger, along with many people in South Boston, was aligned with the Irish nationalism groups, in particular the Provisional Irish Republican Army. The IRA was a paramilitary group focused on ending British control in Northern Ireland. They believed in a unified, independent Ireland. They used violence in their efforts to achieve those goals. They targeted British soldiers and political opponents with bombings and shootings in Northern Ireland and in other countries. As I said, Bulger was a true believer in the IRA's mission and wanted to help out in any way he could. On multiple occasions, Bulger sent weapons across the Atlantic for use by the IRA. This came to a sudden end when IRA member Sean O'Callaghan turned on the group and alerted Irish authorities about a shipment in 1984. John McIntyre, who had been a crew member on the ship carrying the weapons, was arrested and flipped on Bulger. Connolly became aware of this and tipped off Bulger and Flemmy. Bulger tortured and killed McIntyre shortly thereafter in a house in Southie. He then ordered Weeks and Flemmy to remove all of McIntyre's teeth and bury him in the basement. Winter Hill was also involved in the drug trade, but not in the typical way. Not at first, at least. They didn't feel comfortable getting involved directly in selling drugs, so instead they extorted any distributors who wanted to deal in Boston. If they wanted to sell there, they had to cut Whitey in. While Bulger certainly ran a lot of rackets in Boston and did so successfully, he has become best known for his brutality. In 1980, a bookie started to cause problems for Bulger. He was a loudmouth and had pissed off other bookies, but more importantly, he wasn't cutting Whitey in on all of his operations, and it killed two people without getting the green light. The bookie was found in a garbage bag in the trunk of his car in South Boston a few weeks later. He had been stabbed with an ice pick and shot. In 1981, Bulger ordered the murder of Roger Wheeler, a businessman from Tulsa. One of Wheeler's business adventures was hi-alai. Hi-alai is a sport that you're going to have to Google if you want more info because I really can't explain it. But the important thing to know is that it was somewhat popular in the 60s through the 80s in the United States, specifically in Florida, as a sport to bet on. Wheeler owned World Hi-Alai in Miami. He had unearthed an embezzlement scheme by Bulger and his associates, where the mobsters would skim money off of parking lot revenues. Possessing information that put Whitey Bulger in danger of jail time was a very dangerous position to be in. On May 27, 1981, Wheeler was murdered in the parking lot at Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa. As I stated earlier, the hit was ordered by Whitey Bulger, but was carried out by Johnny Martirano. I talked about Martirano in last week's episode, but to recap, he was a contract killer who ultimately confessed to carrying out 20 murders on behalf of Bulger and other criminals in Boston. After the Wheeler murder, Martirano also killed John Callahan, who had knowledge of Wheeler's murder. Bulger had determined that Callahan couldn't be trusted to keep his mouth shut if he was questioned by authorities. His body was found in the trunk of a car at Miami International Airport. In 1982, Bulger became aware that Edward Brian Halloran approached the FBI with information about a murder previously committed by Bulger and Flemmy. John Connolly, who at this point was essentially working for Bulger, tipped him off about it. A short time later, in May 1982, the decision was made to take out Halloran. Halloran was having dinner at Anthony's Pier 4 restaurant. When he left the establishment, Bulger, Weeks, and a third man were waiting for him. Weeks signaled to Bulger via walkie-talkie when Halloran exited the restaurant. Bulger and the third man ran up on the vehicle and opened fire. Michael Donahue, Halloran's friend who had agreed to give him a ride home, was killed instantly. Halloran survived for a short period of time before passing away. There's been a lot of debate about who the second gunman was, but it has never been conclusively established. In 1983, Bulger killed Arthur Bucky Barrett. Barrett was a master jewel thief and had recently scored over $1.5 million in a huge bank heist. The problem is, Barrett didn't kick up to Whitey. Even worse, he actually gave a cut of the money to the Italians instead. This was not going to fly. Bulger allegedly shot and killed Barrett in the same Southie basement where John McIntyre would be killed a year later. In 1985, another Bulger victim would be killed in that same basement. Deborah Hussey, who was Stephen Fleming's girlfriend's daughter, ran afoul of Winter Hill after she tried to use their names to get out of trouble when she was arrested for drug possession. Bulger allegedly strangled her to death. The bodies of Barrett, McIntyre, and Hussey were all found in the basement in 2000. Bulger's reign of terror continued on into the early 1990s. By this point in time, local law enforcement were all over Bulger. They had intel that he was involved with the drug trade and were actively trying to flip distributors and get them to admit that Bulger was shaking them down. One of these distributors was John Shea, who ran the drug trade in South Boston. Shea was arrested in 1990 but refused to cooperate in the investigation into Bulger. He could have easily informed on Bulger and received a reduced sentence, but he didn't do it. At this point, Bulger was in his 60s and had avoided trouble with the law since his return to Boston nearly 30 years prior. But his luck was about to run out. In 1994, the DEA launched an investigation into Bulger with the help of Boston Police and the Massachusetts State Police. They focused in on his gambling operations and went after bookies who had paid protection money to Bulger. John Connolly would have usually used his influence to shut this down in its early stages, but he didn't even know about it. The agencies I mentioned believed that the FBI was compromised when it came to Bulger, and they stopped providing info to the FBI. They were convinced that Connolly would blow things up. He did eventually catch wind of the investigation when it became apparent indictments were imminent in late 1994. He informed Bulger that he needed to leave town as soon as possible. Bulger took this advice and fled Boston on December 23, 1994. He spent time in New York, Louisiana, California, and Florida before returning to Boston. When he came back, Kevin Weeks met up with him and brought along Bulger's girlfriend, Catherine Gregg. Bulger and his girlfriend then set out for their new lives as fugitives. Weeks had taken over the gang as Fleming was arrested shortly after Bulger fled Boston. He met with Bulger multiple times while he was on the run, including in New York and Chicago, but the visit stopped in 1995. Weeks was arrested in 1999 and eventually cut a deal with the feds. He told them everything, where the money was stashed, where the bodies were buried, everything. But of course, none of that mattered if they couldn't find Whitey. Prosecutors finally caught up to John Connolly and the depth of his corruption was finally uncovered. As you have heard in this episode, he constantly killed investigations into Bulger and kept him updated on who had the potential to rat on him. This directly led to multiple murders by Bulger in Winter Hill. Probably asking yourself, why would Connolly do this? Well, he would maintain that he did it to get information on the Mafia and that it was all for the greater good. Maybe that is partially true, but I have to believe the massive amounts of cash that Bulger paid him and the lifestyle it brought with it had more to do with it. Connolly was convicted in 2002 for obstruction of justice and racketeering for his role in protecting Bulger and was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. And he next had to deal with the state of Florida. I talked earlier about the murder of John Callahan. He was killed due to his knowledge about the Roger Wheeler murder. The kicker is that Bulger ordered the murder only after Connolly told him that Callahan was about to be investigated for his ties to Winter Hill and the death of Wheeler. Fleming, Martorano, and Weeks all testified against Connolly in this trial, detailing his relationship with Bulger. Their testimony also revealed how careless Connolly had been with the bribe money he was paid. He had purchased boats, condos, land, none of which made sense on his relatively modest FBI salary. In November 2008, Connolly was convicted of second-degree murder for the death of Callahan and ultimately sentenced to 40 years in prison, which he would serve after his stint in federal prison. He was released from federal custody in 2011 and handed over to Florida. He was released from state prison in early 2021 for medical reasons. It was estimated that he had less than a year to live. However, Connolly is still alive as of today and lives in Massachusetts. Bulger and his girlfriend, after having plastic surgery to help hide their appearance, eventually settled in Santa Monica, California. The FBI was embarrassed by what had happened with Bulger, and they stepped up the efforts to track him down in the mid-2000s. They looked everywhere, Italy, Canada, and all over the United States. Eventually, they did track him down in Santa Monica. He had been on the run for more than 16 years. He was found with more than $800,000 in cash, guns, and fake identification documents. Bulger was brought back to Boston and immediately started cooperating with law enforcement. He was put on trial in federal court in 2013 and after a lengthy trial was convicted on 31 counts, including racketeering and weapons charges. Multiple murders were wrapped up in the racketeering charges as well. He was sentenced to 2 life sentences plus 5 years. After spending time at federal prisons in Florida and Oklahoma, Bulger was transferred to Hazleton Federal Penitentiary in West Virginia on October 29, 2018. He was found dead in his cell the very next morning. He had been beaten to death and suffered serious cuts to his eyes and tongue. He was 89 years old. The most common theory is that he was killed by order of the mafia as revenge for his years of informing on them to the FBI. The Whitey Bulger story is fascinating on multiple fronts. For starters, he had an enormous amount of power in Boston for decades while only having a few close associates. The rest of the criminals fell in line out of fear. But what is even more interesting to me is the John Connolly piece. Both men grew up in the same neighborhood, the same housing project, but they forged very different paths early on. Connolly with the FBI, Bulger with organized crime. This South Boston connection was what allowed Connolly to bring Bulger into the fold, but it also had a lot to do with Connolly getting in too deep. He never shook that awestruck feeling he got from Bulger as a kid. He was willing to lose everything in his life to protect a career criminal and dip his toes in the gangster lifestyle. Thank you so much for listening to Episode 6 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. Thanks again, and have a great day.